This is an ABC podcast.
In 1979, Western Australia celebrated 150 years since the British established a colony on the west coast of Australia. A youthful Prince Charles was there to unveil a statue of the state's first governor, Captain James Stirling. Last year, this statue was covered in red, yellow and black paint, the colours of the Aboriginal flag, as part of a Black Lives Matter protest in Perth. Hi, Kirsty Melville with you, bringing you the History Listen today from the lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people. In the lead-up to Western Australia's bicentenary in 2029, new questions are being asked of its first governor, including his involvement in frontier violence and the British slave trade. Historian Georgina Arnott is part of a team of researchers investigating the complex legacy of James Stirling, and she takes up the story. And a warning, this episode contains some graphic scenes of violence.
It was December 1979. And Western Australia was commemorating the arrival of its first fleet. A reenactment took place on a white sandy beach.
A big number of people in pleasure boats made the trip to Garden Island to watch the reenactment. They joined about 200 invited guests who crowded tiny Cliff Point on Sulphur Bay, the spot where Captain James Stirling and his band of settlers stepped ashore some 150 years ago.
James Stirling was the founding governor of Western Australia.
This is Dr. Jeremy Martins, an historian at the University of Western Australia.
So he started off as a lieutenant governor. He was instrumental in convincing the British government to authorise a settlement being set up at Swan River. And he remained a governor until the late 1830s, until 1839.
During the latter parts of the ceremony, the Premier, Sir Charles Court, paid tribute to Captain Stirling, who he said was a man of great vision and courage. A commemorative plaque erected at a memorial to Captain Stirling's historic landing was unveiled by the West Australian Governor, Sir Wallace Kyle.
As the Minister responsible for the 150th, I'm really thrilled to bits about it. Yeah, the whole thing's gone marvellously well. The personal involvement, the excitement that's been generated by people, the fact that even men are getting dressed up. It's really everybody's party and everybody's loving it.
The 1979 reenactment, marking 150 years since James Stirling landed, was not, it turns out, the first of its kind.
Captain Stirling explored the Swan River in 1827.
In 1954, this educational film was made based on his arrival on the west coast of Australia.
I have the honour to communicate, Your Excellency, the result of my exploring visit to the western coast of New Holland. About midday on the 5th of March, 1827, we sighted the island of Rottnest.
In a report, James Stirling recorded his journey up the Swan River, where he first encountered the Noongar.
On this day, we first made contact with the natives who appeared on the bank. At first, we were not troubled, but later, where the river narrowed, they appeared in strength and adopted a threatening attitude. They followed our boats along the shore, the women and children keeping out of sight. Then they began to shout, and it seemed as though we would soon get a shower of spears. We pursued our course until the bank became nearly level with the water, by which time they seemed more friendly.
In recent years, Stirling's account of largely peaceful relations with Noongar has been questioned. At stake is how we remember a figure like James Stirling and whether he should be honoured in place names, statues, reenactments, films and our history books.
My name's Cole Baxter. I'm a Noongar man. That sums it up.
In 2021, Cole led a movement to rename the city of Stirling in the northern suburbs of Perth.
The city of Stirling is a collection of 30 suburbs in a rather strange shape. And my people have existed here for 50,000 plus years. That's a tremendous amount of time, longer than, say, 230 years to reflect James Stirling's arrival on Noongar country.
Cole says the Black Lives Matter movement has made people rethink how the past is inscribed in the places they live. Things such as the name of the city of Stirling and statues like the one of James Stirling in central Perth.
What this fella was intrinsic to was dismantling the way of life of Noongar and Aboriginal people here in Western Australia. Even to this day, Noongars, many of us live in poverty because of the direct actions from this bloke, and that's what we've inherited from him. We didn't want to inherit that from him.
As part of the movement to rename the city of Stirling, Cole gave media interviews and posted on social media with the support of Noongar elders Len Collard and John Maguire.
Good afternoon, my name is John Maguire. I am Whadjuk Ballardong, First Nations Noongar man, and I have connection to country here in the metropolitan area of Perth.
John is too modest to say it, but in the 1980s, he was a first-grade AFL and cricket player at a time when Western Australia dominated the baggy green. He says there wasn't a match when he wasn't racially abused. So as a senior Noongar Whadjuk man, what's John's take on James Stirling?
I was only a lad when James Stirling sailed up the Swan River. I don't mean that really. That was in 1829 it was, when colonisation happened and Stirling sailed up the Swan River. And we know now, and we knew then as Aboriginal people, that it wasn't an unoccupied country, unoccupied territory. It was traversed and crossed and walked on for thousands of years prior to that by a whole range of people, and that acknowledgement wasn't forthcoming.
...2021 was not the first time Noongar people had called for renaming around James Stirling. Over 20 years earlier, in 1998... the state's Aboriginal Legal Service highlighted Stirling's involvement in frontier violence and called for his name to be expunged.
According to the ALS's Dennis Eggington, it all began last century when Aboriginal trust was brutally and fatally shattered, dozens dying at what's known as the Pinjarra Massacre. Former state governor Captain James Stirling was considered among the villains of the peace. And now the sudden death of an Aboriginal activist has brought a renewed campaign to expose the truth from the historical record.
In the eyes of Noongar people, this man is a mass murderer. He led a massacre on men, women and children, and that's how we remember him.
So, as an act of reconciliation, Mr. Eggington has proposed to expunge all reference to Stirling from the public record.
I mean, the whole country was rewritten. Aboriginal people had names for everything in this country, and I guess that was completely wiped out and rewritten.
The mayor of the city of Stirling considers that approach unrealistic.
So let's get on with life. Let's forget about the past.
There's a statue of Stirling outside the public library in the middle of town, but it's small. It's much smaller than he actually was, and it's not very, certainly not uplifting.
Captain Stirling explored the Swan River in 1827.
I'm Dr. Pamela Statham-Drew. I'm affiliated with the Royal Western Australian Historical Society, of which I am councillor and secretary for my sins.
Pamela is retired now, but for 42 years was an economic historian at the University of Western Australia. In 2003, she wrote a biography of James Stirling. What does she make of calls for renaming?
I totally object to them wiping the name and putting in an Aboriginal name, because I think it would be very, very unfair. If it hadn't been Stirling, it would have been someone else. So just getting rid of his name is really quite pointless. He just happened to be the person who came in leading a lot of other people. But I do agree to having two together. I think having the two together is very good.
Given Pamela's extensive research, did James Stirling ever reflect on the presence of Noongar in the early colony?
At the Legislative Council, on the 22nd of June 1837, Stirling referred to us as the invaders and the Aboriginals as the invaded.
Discussion of Stirling's legacy often settles around his role in a bloody clash in 1834 between settlers and Noongar at a place called Pinjarra. Historian Jeremy Martins.
Pinjarra is almost directly south of Perth, about 80 kilometres south of Perth. Very accessible now, just off the main highway heading south.
So Pinjarra was located 80 kilometres away from the main settlement of Perth. It seems like a long way to go in the days before cars or highways. But within a few years, Stirling was allocating land grants to settlers.
There, the Pinjarra Noongar communities were resisting the expansion of the settlement there. And so Stirling, in around about 1834, informed officials in London that the Pinjarra people, and this is a quote, threatened to destroy all the whites in the district, end quote. And Stirling insisted that a punitive action would be required to defeat the resistance.
Stirling, he wants to set up an outpost at Pinjarra so that they can give away more land to some of the settlers who were entitled to larger land grants, but there was none left up around the Swan. So Stirling decides to take his police force down with him.
Such is the contested nature of Australian colonial history that some refer to the events that took place in Pinjarra as a battle, while others call it a massacre. But no one doubts that Stirling led a group of his armed men to Pinjarra on the 28th of October, 1834.
James Stirling, with a party of some 24 soldiers and settlers, purposefully attacked a Pinjarra encampment. And this camp consisted of something like 80 men, women and children who were camping on the banks of the Murray River.
And there ensued a battle, and there's no other word for it, because the Aboriginals could have disappeared, gone backwards into the scrub. There was no force behind them. There was only a force in front of them. And they gave back, you know, what they were getting.
So by the way that Stirling directed the violence on the day of the attack, it's clear also that he intended to kill large numbers of people, because one part of Stirling's mounted force charged the camp, and in doing so, they forced men, women and children towards the Murray River. And that's where Stirling himself and the rest of the force lay in ambush, and that's when they opened fire.
Stirling yelled out after 1 hour to cease hostilities.
And Stirling's force killed something between 15 and 80 people, and possibly more. In response, one colonist was killed and another was wounded.
So, what sources have historians and others used for understanding the events that took place at Pinjarra?
Surveyor General John Septimus Rowe recorded in his notebooks, which he took with him, they were his surveying record books, a sort of diary of exactly what happened and where people were standing. So that was one. Then Meade, who was a settler, Colonel Meade, who lived on the Upper Swan and wanted to take out land at Pinjarra, the new land at Pinjarra. He and his son were with Stirling.
Well, there are several written sources. These were generally produced by Europeans at the time of or in the years after the massacre took place. But of course, there are also Noongar oral histories, and these have been passed down and recorded as well. And as West Australian historian Chris Owen has pointed out in his research on Pinjarra, most colonists at the time, or certainly in 1834, referred to the event as a skirmish or an affray, as a punitive expedition that was designed to defeat the Pinjarra resistance to colonisation. However, as Stirling had declared Noongar people to be British subjects protected by British laws, in fact, his proclamation in 1829 when the Swan River Colony was proclaimed, he clearly made the point that Noongar people were British subjects and therefore they were protected by British laws. So this fact, the fact that Noongar people were British subjects, meant there was a strong disincentive to be open and honest about the extent of extrajudicial violence that had taken place at Pinjarra.
Blackfellas pass down stories through yarning, not through the written form, but of course that is the dominant form that history is recorded in. And for most of the time, history is recorded in the selective opinions of the colonists.
But 30 years after the events of Pinjarra, Jeremy Martin says a very different version of the story started to emerge from settlers themselves.
An account supposedly written by Corporal Haggerty of the 63rd Regiment characterised Pinjarra, and this is a quote, as the indiscriminate slaughter of a harmless and unoffending tribe where 200 to 300 peaceable natives were deliberately shot down, end quote. So that was still in the 19th century, 30 years later.
In 1834, James Stirling said, no one would be allowed to remain alive on this side of the mountains. And this was a warning to Noongar people against retaliating to the Pinjarra massacre. And for any Stirling historian, if they go to the letters that he sent to the colonial secretary at the time, who was Lord Glenelg in London, they will be able to find that.
Stirling wrote, the punishment had been inflicted because of the misconduct of the tribe, that the white men never forget to punish murder, that on this occasion the women and children had been spared, but if any other person should be killed by them, not one would be allowed to remain on this side of the mountains, end quote.
This bloke said this way. There's no other way around it. How can you spin that other than just completely disregarding it?
Jeremy Martin says that for Stirling, violence was a way of telling Noongar that his settlers were not going anywhere. Violence from Noongar was perhaps saying the same thing. The shadow surrounding the story of Captain James Stirling reaches further back than the colonisation of Western Australia. For around 200 years before the Royal Navyman arrived, the British Empire was centred in the West Indies. It was all about extracting sweet riches, sugar and coffee. At the same time as convicts were being transported to East Coast Australia, the British were enslaving Africans on the islands of the West Indies to produce those riches. And James Stirling's family was right in the thick of it.
I'm Diana Payton. I'm a historian of the Caribbean and I work at the University of Edinburgh.
At Port Royal in Jamaica, the British Navy was commanded by James Stirling's uncle, Charles, who was a father figure to the young James. In 1812, James was made a captain and stationed in Jamaica for the following 6 years.
The Royal Navy had always been very important in the British Empire, and the Caribbean in the 18th century was right at the heart of the British Empire, and it's still a very important part of the British Empire in the early 19th century. The Navy also provided protection to the ships that are operating the slave trade. So bringing human cargoes across the Atlantic, engaged in human trafficking, we would say now. The Royal Navy is also a really important line of defence for the planters, for the enslavers, against uprisings and rebellions and revolutionary wars on the part of enslaved people. Without military force, slavery couldn't have continued. You can't sustain the incredibly harsh exploitation of 90% of the population without physical violence and the threat of force and violence being used to sustain it.
The Port Royal Naval Station, where James Stirling was likely to have been based, was just across the bay from one of Jamaica's largest towns, Kingston.
Stirling would probably have been most familiar with urban slavery, all the kind of jobs of everyday life, if you like, the jobs that keep an urban economy running were done by enslaved people. So domestic servants were enslaved, the people who were working in transport were enslaved. So he would have encountered taverns and lodging houses where the people working there would have been enslaved. So slavery was everywhere in Jamaica. It was all around.
Most of the people enslaved in Jamaica were labouring in sugar production. James Stirling's great-grandfather, Andrew Buchanan, pioneered the trade in sugar between the West Indies and his home city of Glasgow. Before sugar, Buchanan was already one of the wealthiest men in the city, and this wealth came from enslaving Africans on tobacco plantations. Buchanan, with two other of James Stirling's great-grandfathers, was part of a group known as Tobacco Lords. And by the time young James Stirling came along, the family was still importing slave-produced goods from Jamaica. When the tobacco lord Andrew Buchanan turned to West Indian sugar, he started the first sugar processing house in Glasgow. It fed the taste for sugar across continental Europe. But the sweet stuff came at a heavy price for thousands and thousands of enslaved Africans.
Sugar production was very, very intensive, especially during the crop time, which lasted for about half the year. And so people would be first digging the cane holes. At harvest time, it'd be cut by machete and then taken to sugar mills where it would be crushed, the juice squeezed out, and then boiled in a boiling house at very, very high temperatures as the sugar crystallizes, and then taken and stored and eventually shipped to Britain. So all of those processes are very intense and often very dangerous.
As a young naval captain in Jamaica, James Stirling received extra pay for safeguarding British merchant ships loaded with sugar. His logbooks show dozens of African crew members. Sometimes these were freed slaves. Other times they were enslaved by ship captains or by the Navy itself.
There were deliberate efforts in the 1790s by the British government to enlist significant numbers of newly enslaved Africans into British military forces in order to expand the British military that was capable of fighting in the Caribbean.
We don't know much about James Stirling's direct involvement in slavery, but we do know that he was handsomely rewarded for capturing enemy vessels laden with slave-produced sugar and coffee. In 1 year alone, with this reward money, Stirling invested the equivalent of £140,000 into his family's trading house. The other thing that we do know is that one of the Stirling brothers was a slave owner in Barbados.
So over time, you get these dense networks across the British Empire that interlock merchant wealth, plantation development, military and naval careers, and Indian connections. That's very common. It's something that we're finding out about more as this kind of empire family has become a preoccupation for many historians who are interested in the connections that joined the different parts of the empire.
James Stirling was one of about 200 people that we know of so far who profited from Atlantic slavery before arriving in Australia. How this shaped what Stirling and these other people did once in this country is something that we're just beginning to investigate. This research into slavery and its connection to Australia is illuminating the ties that bind empire, race, and history together. And how this continues to bubble up in the present.
The proposal by some ratepayers came in light of Sir James Stirling's involvement in an 1834 massacre of Aboriginal people in Pinjarra.
And remember that call that we heard about earlier in the program from Noongar man Cole Baxter and others to rename the city of Stirling?
Council decided not to change the name.
It's disappointing because the name Stirling holds a significant place in our history.
But it voted against a motion to formally commit to keeping it.
It was simply saying that as part of our Reconciliation Action Group, it would be detrimental for us to reaffirm the name Stirling, particularly in this climate.
Because of the ignorance that is out there in terms of what Stirling spearheaded, in terms of massacres, Pinjarra, of course, we've heard about, but also the history of the individual, people are hurt. People have been hurt through our history and through the policies that impacted on us. But if we can embrace Aboriginal people and First Nations people right around the country and embrace their history and their existence and acknowledge names that were there long before colonisation, that would really go a long way to improving the relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal.
Because the path to reconciliation benefits Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, and also it requires both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people.
So changing the name for us as Noongar gives us a sense of a new beginning.
Commemorating James Stirling was written and narrated by Dr. Georgina Arnott from the University of Melbourne, who was one of the ABC's 2021 Top 5 Humanities Scholars. With fellow historians Professors Jane Lydon and Zoe Laidlaw and Dr. Jeremy Martins, she's part of a research project exploring the legacies of British slavery in Australia. The sound engineer on today's show was Carey Dell. And I'm Kirsty Melville. I'll catch you next time here on The History Listen. See you then. If you're keen to hear more about the contested frontier history of Western Australia, then I urge you to check out Background Briefing's recent episode, The Ghosts Are Not Silent. It's set in the beautiful southwest corner of WA, and it's the story of reporter Sam Carmody's search for answers about his family history. What Sam discovers is disturbing, and it has implications not just for his family, but for the entire region, where his ancestors have a statue in their honour, a highway, and even a town named after them. It's a very personal reckoning with Australian history. You can find Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.